First and foremost, we are going to, as part of the continued celebration of the Entrepreneur Journey's Billion Dollar Unicorns book, we're going to talk today with Gaurav Dhillon. Gaurav has an absolutely amazing, amazing track record in the technology business. He has founded Informatica, which was a public company and a sustained public company as a multi-billion dollar market cap entity. And then he went on to found SnapLogic, which currently is a private unicorn, as we are calling it in the current terminology. It has got a billion-dollar valuation in the private market. And what I have found absolutely amazing in talking to Gaurav, you know, over time is his methodology. You know, some people can do it once, and some people can wing it, but people who have really thought it deeply, thought about it deeply to see, to develop methodology that lets them do something, you know, of this scale, of this magnitude over and over again, are very rare in the industry. Gaurav, welcome. It's a great pleasure to have you on. Thank you for making the time.
It's my pleasure, Shamrana. It's always nice to talk to you, and you're very kind.
So, I think what we should focus on, and you can draw from both Informatica and SnapLogic, but let's kind of start with the methodology of how you, you know, sniff out the core nuggets in an opportunity. That's what I found amazing in talking to you, is that you really have a very good handle on that methodology.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with the people we have and the timing we have, but there is sort of over time and from our mistakes a method to the madness or a methodology that has evolved. You know, I'd say, you know, when we look at these things, I've always been enamored of big changes in a computing platform or big changes in the world, right? I got into software because I'm sort of a child of the microprocessor age. My father brought home a computer from a conference, and I started learning how to program and so on. So I've been doing this for a very long time, but I'm always excited by what is next, what is the change that is going on, and how can we, in that change, create a ton of value, right? It starts with curiosity, and then it gets into sort of an execution mode. So I'd say, if you look at the similarities between us here at SnapLogic, some of the other great companies that have been formed in the cloud, like Workday or Salesforce, I think there's a striking parallel to some of the predecessor work that some of those people had done. So in my case, what we managed to do at Informatica was sort of seize the day, take the tide, at a point when people were coming off mainframes into client-server computing in the 90s. And, you know, I'm of a vintage where that is very vivid to me, and that was a time that was very exciting because when, you know, large companies were redoing their business computing platform, they were buying new applications, ERP applications, you know, PeopleSoft, Siebel, et cetera, and as a result, they needed to knit them together. And they turned to products from Informatica, and we built a great company on the back of that over my 12 years as CEO. What we're doing at SnapLogic is something very similar in that we see this move to cloud computing, the move to big data, as sort of tectonic. These are at the scale of, you know, the Earth's plate, the Earth's crust moving, and they're much bigger than client server. It was sort of very, very exciting to see the change happening, and happening sort of all at the same time, fed by the cloud itself, right? So in a sense, we're bootstrapping this change by using inexpensive cloud, et cetera. So now if you boil that up, my sort of takeaway on this is, look, it's like opening a combination lock, right? Think of a combination lock where you have three tumblers. You know, if you don't open all three things, the market doesn't open to you. I think the first and perhaps most important struggle for all young companies, the early days of Informatica, you know, until we got public, the first couple of years here at SnapLogic, have been very similar in that you go through product market fit iteration, right? You have a product, you have a vivid imagination of what the market is, and then you engage very directly and very intimately with a number of customers, and you figure out how to modulate your product, its pricing, its packaging, sort of the 4 or 5 B's, and you find a way to get product market fit. What you know you have it when you identify the job title of the buyer of your product, and you can figure out that they are the same person in a variety of vertical industries, aerospace, you know, banking, on and on to pharmaceuticals, et cetera, et cetera. So as you go through the ABCs of various vertical sectors and you find a job title that you can sell to, you've sort of identified product market fit, your pricing starts to shake out, your sales gets more repeatable. They're not quite, you know, as exciting. They get to be somewhat dull. You know, this is what we're going to do. We have a playbook. You know, so you sort of nail it, and then you have to think about how you're going to go scale it. So in there, I think the next two elements of the product market fit having been achieved are how do we approach the market in a way that our pricing and distribution methodology are in sync with the market, right? So if you have product market fit, now you have to figure out what is your model to go tackle that market. And the model to tackle that market for a lot of the enterprise was and still is being able to do that through a direct sales force and partnerships with the system integrators. I mean, this is a complex business. I wish it were as simple as buying a mobile phone, and I'm sure those aren't simple for my friends who are in that business. They tell me all the complexities and the chips and the progress and the versions and so on. So again, from afar, it feels like our business is more complex in some ways because it touches so many things. But what we found is that once you have product market fit, now you have to figure out your distribution strategy. And a very simple way to think about it is, look, we know how big Starbucks is from counting their stores, right? How many stores does Starbucks have? And of course, then they have a variety of partnerships and distribution and grocery stores, et cetera. But its very essence, a complex technology business, is a function of its sales teams, the men and women who are ambassadors for that company in various points across the United States and the globe. They represent the company with, in our case, very big on integrity and very big on intensity, as well as sort of very innovative conversations. And they present the company ably to a buyer who has a problem. And now you have sort of the scale out, which is how do you go about building it? And perhaps the third thing, if I might carry on this for a second, get on the soapbox for a second. The third thing is you really have to think about diversity in your customers, right? So if you find success, say, at a telco, it is tempting to try to gain, you know, sort of profit and try to go deeper into that vertical because the next sale to a telco is much easier if you already have sold a telco, right? And this is where I think, you know, as an entrepreneur, I've learned to come home and have a little conversation with myself. And great, we got this big deal at company X, you know, say we had something happen wonderful at a pharmaceutical company whose name begins with an A. Great. But I now want to make sure that I have a bank whose name begins with an A as my next set of targets. So you have to be sort of very careful, and you know, it could vary. For certain businesses, verticalization is the way to go, and certainly applications, analytic applications in particular, are very much by vertical, organized by vertical rather than, you know, as a horizontal platform like an Oracle or, you know, SnapLogic or Informatica, whatever. But my view has been, you know, nail it, scale it, and now try to build a force in the world by having multiple customers in multiple industries who appreciate your products. And at that point, I think you basically got what I call the ideal slide, right? Industry 1, 2, 3, 4, logo ABCD, logo ABCD, logo ABCD, and so on and so on. So now you're at a point where you can sort of graduate college as a company, and the rest of your life begins. So that's what I would boil it up to.
Interesting. So let me synthesize a few things for our audience here. What you heard Gaurav describe is, you know, the thought process behind building two horizontal integration companies focused on enterprise customers. And all of those, you know, points are important. Horizontal, enterprise, right? We're not talking about SME go-to-market strategy. We're not talking about vertical enterprise go-to-market strategy. We're talking about a horizontal enterprise product, and the whole discussion so far has been focused on that because Gaurav has immense domain knowledge in that particular area. And the whole, you know, the integration story of Informatica, the data integration and Informatica, SnapLogic, it's a very particular problem. And it's a problem that is actually has seen several companies come into existence and come into scale. Those of you who have been following these series, you met Ross Mason, the CEO of MuleSoft recently here. Ross has also built a unicorn company or close to unicorn company in the integration space using an open source strategy, also horizontal integration. So just to kind of give you a feel for how significant companies are being built in the integration space. Now, Gaurav, back to you. So your prior generation companies, we've seen some news lately. So Informatica just went private. TIBCO went private a little while earlier. These were two previous generation, very large scale integration based software companies that went public and went on to become very big. Give us your analysis of the market dynamics of those transactions. Oops, the audio has cut off. Just a second.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, yes, they're managing the audio. I saw it go red and now it's back on again. So there's a bit of a delay. I'll time my answers accordingly. So you know, I think the story of companies growing and then stalling in the enterprise software business is an old one. You know, there's only a certain number of companies with $1 billion in revenue, and that cycle comes and goes. So I think the common thread in the integration business with TIBCO and with Informatica, I would say, you know, is the fact that these companies were fundamentally built before the World Wide Web existed. You know, it's not like we were trying to limit the potential of those technologies when we're building them, myself at Informatica or Vivek Rana Dive over TIBCO, but we could only do what we could with the tools and products in front of us. You know, I like to joke that we're very advanced because we use C++ from Borland. Microsoft didn't have a C++ compiler at the time, and so we broke a lot of new ground, but the web wasn't around. And I, you know, it's so trite to say it, but the web has changed everything. You know, we have billions of people using the web in a manner that is distributed, multilingual, generally works really well, very inexpensive, very affordable, and it's causing some of these revolutions with your incubator and the work that you're doing here. But the web changed the compute platform and led to SaaS, people using browsers to balance their books, not buy books. And when the enterprise, it was very clear, was going to jump into a web model for their application portfolio, for their business computing needs, then it was pretty clear to us, and sort of the founding synthesis behind SnapLogic, that the existing companies would not be able to solve those problems well. You know, you'd be putting trying to put a round peg in a square hole, or, you know, it would not be a good fit for the products that were built before the web existed. You know, they're designed to run behind the firewall, the data types are relational, the web has very different unstructured data types, and so on. But getting out of the guts of it, I think what you have seen is classic innovator's dilemma, right? These companies had to keep selling what they've got and try to sell more and more to the existing customers, the product that they had at greater and greater discounts in an effort to stem try to break out of the stall that they were in. And because that's by definition almost impossible to do, there's no option but to sell the company, like PeopleSoft was acquired by Oracle, sort of in the first generation Siebel, PeopleSoft. In the case of middleware companies, with the rise of private equity, there has been a series of private equity transactions because of pressure from activist shareholders, and that pressure has come because the companies haven't grown, their stock prices lag, S&P 500, their stock prices lag a variety of other high-tech indexes, and activist shareholders take an ownership stake in the company and force them to be sold. So this is the takeaway we have, which is, you know, unfortunately for many of the individual contributors in these companies, and unfortunately for many of the customers of these companies, this is not a good thing. Because leveraged buyouts, by definition, take on a lot of debts. That debt needs to be serviced. There's always pronouncements about, oh, we're going to innovate or change models. But the truth is, you're trading one pressures on earnings per share with another set of pressures, which is paying back your debt. And so it's a Faustian fact, in my opinion. It's unfortunate for many, many good people who will be let go, as they are post these private equity transactions, in an effort to pay back debts and service the needs of the leverage required to do these multi-billion dollar deals. And it's generally not been good for customers or job creation. So our take is, look, it was inevitable. There was always hope that a large company would just buy it and become part of the foundation, which I think would have been a kinder, gentler way to go. But we'll see what happens. And as far as we're concerned, we're sort of cleared for takeoff, right? Both those market spaces have opened up for us.
So to, you know, tie these two segment discussions together, the one thing you said earlier on is about tectonic shifts in the industry. And in a way, these two companies are kind of victims of that tectonic shift. Cloud has really taken over the you know, software, even enterprise software, has become very modular, where different cloud providers mm-hmm. providing different modular pieces of value. And now you have to tie all these pieces together, make them interplay, and draw data from one to the other, and you know, seamlessly. And that has created a very different architectural need in these enterprises from the point of view of integration, which is what has now opened up opportunities for new companies like SnapLogic and like MuleSoft that we talked about earlier.
I would agree.
Discontinuity such as this often opens up opportunities for new architectures and new products in the market. Now, what is, again, back to your methodology, when you talk to customers, I know you are very, very focused on customer immersion, and that's, you know, we talk about customer immersion as a core methodology, like a parrot, you know, in our program. So this is like completely underpinned on the customer immersion methodology. When you talk to customers, I'm going to double click down on that a bit and ask you for some, you know, subtleties and points of views. When you talk to customers, do you start with your observation, your hypothesis about their problem, or do you ask questions and get them to tell you what is going on in their shops and what are they struggling with? You know, what is methodology?
It's always problem solution, right? This is sort of, you know, one of the greatest investment bankers in high tech, Frank Cotrone, who did the Informatica IPO for us, and so on, and he just ended up doing the LBO for the whole company as well. But, you know, he really perfected, I think, the art of this conversation in talking to investors or talking to customers even. I've used that over and over. So it's problem solution, from darkness into light. Our job is to understand what their problems are and not try to color them by commentary about belief, about our beliefs. Because oftentimes, and particularly, you know, in our early days in the business, there's a sort of this desire to say your gut, look at all this wonderful stuff I worked hard on, you know. But it doesn't have the resonance unless you've understood the customer's problem. And if you understand the customer's problem, and, you know, I'm a big sort of fan of old-fashioned note-taking. There was an article recently that said, look, when you type on a computer, you're just you're not listening as actively. And maybe because I grew up writing, You know, I write this stuff down, and I try to listen as actively as I can to the problem this person's telling me, not just to see if I can help them, but also to build my market intelligence, to really have that battle go the way we want it to go. We want to know the terrain, what the customers are looking at, and find patterns of repeatability. Those are breakpoints for innovative companies to sort of wedge into and then expand from there into great companies, from small to great, in that sort of fashion. So it is always customer first. We should ask them what's going on, you know, depending on what they're, you know, once you get off sports, whether it's football or cricket, you quickly get into what are some of the things going on in the business, what keeps them up at night. And, you know, it's interesting. If you learn the art of open-ended conversation with them, you will learn a lot about their problem, and you understand how to serve their needs better. And again, you build that market intelligence in a way that nothing else can give you. No amount of reading gives you that intelligence. It's that interactivity and the million signals that we pick up in interactive conversation that's given us.
And this kind of conversation works best when you come to a problem with deep domain knowledge, because especially in areas like what SnapLogic is working on, what Informatica has worked on, this is very complex stuff, and the subtleties are domain specific. It's, you know, you have to kind of understand what the customer is talking about to really extract the nuggets, and without that domain knowledge, you wouldn't be able to ask the follow-on questions to pursue the nuggets that are, you know, coming up. And this is true in security. This is true in all the hardcore, you know, areas of technology, I would say. This may not be, actually, I take it back, it's true everywhere. You know, I did one company, you know, I did a bunch of software companies, and then I did a company in fashion e-commerce. It was one of the first fashion e-commerce companies in the world in 1999. It was a bit early, but the thing that we learned from talking to, one thing I did was go talk to personal shoppers at Neiman Marcus and Saks and Nordstrom and so forth. And the thing that they told me, which is completely new to me because I don't operate this way at all, is that customers do not know what looks good on them. They have no clue. They're looking for the personal shoppers to tell them what looks good on them. This was a problem. I understand fashion, but I did not understand that there is a whole class of customers or majority of the customers who do not understand this, and that led us to developing our thesis. So I think some amount of domain knowledge coming from you and then immense domain knowledge coming from the customers, that triangulation is what gets you to the core nugget of a problem. So where are you with SnapLogic? I know you guys are going gangbusters. Give us a little, you know, little summary of where you are.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Things are good. You know, we look to do these things, and, you know, there's so many ways to make a living that, you know, I feel blessed that I've pursued my passions, and those have led to great outcomes for the people involved, investors, employees, and others. So, you know, we're at the point where we have achieved product market fit, and we are massively scaling the business. The macros couldn't be better. You've seen the changes in the incumbent lineup. They've been taken private, getting squeezed by their debt loads. The products are showing their age in the marketplace, and people are listening, and all this news makes people go, you know, maybe we should call that person from SnapLogic who called us back and see what they have. Who knows, right? Who knows? So for us, the timing on this just couldn't be better. From our vantage point, it is now a process of scaling up our business by adding, continuing to innovate. I mean, that's like breathing to us. We continue to innovate, have customer conversations, bring them back to the shop, put them into sort of a trifecta of customer conversation, feedback from the marketplace, partners, competitors, what does an analytics company want from us, you know, what is happening with competing products, it changes, like, for example, the take private of these companies. And the third piece is we always want to have our vision in this conversation. So that innovation will continue for us, but where we are right now is all our time focused on scaling our business. So we've increased our sales force sixfold from Q4 to Q1, six times the people that we had. And it's been a lot of recruitment, hiring, a lot of training. You know, if we don't know ourselves, we won't succeed in the marketplace. And so we're going through that massive sort of ride of scaling up our business. And initially, domestically, we have partnerships overseas. And then the second surge would be global expansion for us as well. So that's sort of where we are with the company.
I'm going to ask you one last question, and I know you have to run. Comment on what's happening in the industry around valuations. The private markets are really bloating up valuations, and there's a question mark around whether public markets are going to be able to sustain those valuations. How are you interpreting the market, and how are you steering SnapLogic through this, you know, quandary?
Well, you know, to me, a unicorn is a company that has $1 billion in revenue. So you know, we focus on company building, Sramana. You know, frankly, I find some of the bragging about valuations that some of the private companies do, I find it unseemly, to be very honest, because I feel that the end result, you know, we are company builders. We're not investment bankers. Our job is to build great businesses that let people solve large problems with which those skills to feed their families. You know, if I look back over my career trajectory, the thing I'm proudest of is that over 100,000 people have PowerCenter, my product, from my 20s, as a job skill on LinkedIn, you know, and they use that skill to feed their families, to have a livelihood, to solve a problem for their family. So I feel like valuation should be a corollary. It should be a side effect of a company's execution of the building of a great company. And so frankly, I think no doubt there's this distortion at the very early stages, and at the pre-IPO stage, there's now a distortion as well. But I would say, you know, we should be careful, because we've also seen, you know, I remember seeing Aaron the other day, Aaron Levy at Box, and sort of the struggle he had because of the nature of the valuations, et cetera, going public was actually harder for him. And, you know, I saw him, I'm like, Aaron, what's going on? His hair turned white completely. He's like, this is what happens when you announce an IPO. You know? I'm like, all right, in my case, I'm losing my hair, so maybe we should, you know, figure out a way to meet in the middle here. But you know, it's my advice, which we're taking ourselves, is let's create a great company. You know, on a bad day in NASDAQ, which we haven't had for a while, which is why there's a lot of the stuff going on, we will lose more, quote-unquote, value than some of these discussions. But if we build a great company, then there's enough value for everyone at every stage of the way. And I think there's a sort of a long-term wealth creation for your employees, for your shareholders, and a perpetuity to them. Because what you want to build is a good metabolism. It's like upbringing and having children and so on. You want to have good behavior. You want to have a good metabolism, good habits in the company. So the company can do this for 10 years, 20 years. You know, I haven't done a 30-year company, but certainly Informatica was founded in 1992. My co-founders and I worked very hard to put a culture in the company, extensive, you know, serving the customer in the company. In the early days, that's sort of the first decade or so, and you know, as we got more financial engineering in it, you've seen some of the outcomes. But in my view, the valuation should come from how great is the company. Not good, not hot, right? Hot goes cold, but good doesn't go bad. Ultimately, a good company should wake up every day and say, how do I become a great company? You know, when we had an offsite last week, you would imagine that we would spend all our time talking about, oh, let's hire this person or that person or add this product capability. What about that customer feedback? Instead, we spent a good half of the offsite talking about our values and the culture, the kind of company we want to be, the fact that we would rather lose business than have our salespeople lie to our customers. You know, so these are sort of the things that call me old-fashioned, call me old. You know, I believe in them in that way.
I'm glad you highlighted that, because the market is, again, filling up with speculators. And there was this unbelievably stupid article on VentureBeat the other day about how these later stage funds are investing in quote-unquote unicorns at whatever valuation with no attention to fundamentals, mm-hmm. just to pick the logo and be able to say that we are in this we are investors in this unicorn company. I mean, how much dumber can it get?
We saw it in 1999. It got very, very dumb. You had ballparks full of people who don't even have that on their resumes anymore. I saw so much resume distortion in 2002 and 2003 when we were hiring some of these people from busted.coms, and they wouldn't even put it on there. They would expand the prior job by a year or so. They wouldn't even admit that they had done something. But we saw it, you know, and the Dutch saw the black tulip. So I don't think, I think there's more substance this time around, but I believe there is sort of a lack of discipline about that gratification of building something great. If you can delay that gratification, that is one of the most important things about building a great company. And these are good companies. Some of them will make it, but I think they're constraining themselves artificially with all this valuation talk. They're sort of, in a sense, shackling themselves and preventing greatness because they're focusing, I feel, on the wrong things.
We have, our program is completely focused on the fundamentals, so we don't really get carried away with valuations, and we try to discourage our entrepreneurs to get carried away by these artificial valuation implosions. Well, Gaurav, thank you very much for taking the time.
Indeed, always a pleasure. Thank you. Look forward to a future discussion.
Bye. Take care.